It's not surprising to hear the new president talk about the need to lay out more money on improving and modernizing our military. It's a rare politician who does not call for more spending on defense. It's a proven vote-getter, certainly in America. Our country spends more than any other on defense, but there's plenty spent elsewhere in the world, too. And we do get a global view of the situation in a book by Paul Holden and several other contributors called Indefensible: Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. Paul Holden has been down this road in writing before. His previous books include The Devil in the Detail: How the Arms Deal Changed Everything, and another book called The Arms Deal in Your Pocket. Paul is currently the director of investigations at Corruption Watch UK, which looks into corruption and bribery, assisting journalists, activists, legislators, and prosecutors. Paul Holden, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So a starting point for this discussion, since you work in the exploring corruption game, how close a connection between corruption and arms sales generally?
Unfortunately, incredibly close. We would argue that the defense trade is one of the most corrupt in the entire world, actually. There was a study that was done in 2005 by a quite phenomenal man called Joe Rober. And he accessed a whole range of material, both public and not public, including, apparently, some classified U.S. material. And he used that to estimate the scale of corruption in the arms trade. And what he found was that, well, his estimate was that 40% of all corruption in all global trade relates to the arms trade. That seems to be borne out by a study that was done by the World Bank in 1999-2000, which found that a country with a higher level of defense spending is generally perceived to be more corrupt by its population. Certainly, anecdotally, in all the work that I've done across a number of years, I've come across any number of corruption scandals related to the defense trade. There are a number of key reasons why the trade is so corrupt, which I can go into if you'd like.
Why don't we hang on for that for just a second, because I do want to get to acknowledging the 12 co-authors you list. I mean, who are they and how did you divide up the duties?
It was quite an experience. So what happened was that I've been working very closely with my colleague Andrew Feinstein for the last 10 years or so, and he is the author of a book called The Shadow World, which was the first comprehensive study of the global arms trade since Anthony Sampson's Arms Bazaar in the late 1970s. And we were approached by an organization based out of Tufts University in Boston called the World Peace Foundation. And they wanted to incubate a campaign around the global arms trade, raise awareness around it. So we decided to get together a group of experts that we'd been working with for the last 10 years and see what we could do about it. And as we were sitting around the table discussing things in snowy Boston, we realized that there were a number of different arguments that came up again and again and again in the work that we've done in trying to reform the arms trade. That limits the effectiveness of our work, and we decided that the best thing to do for the public would be to put together a very short guide of answers to those questions, things that you come across again and again in the media if you try to sort of bring the arms trade back under control. In terms of dividing the labor, it was we split into different work groups depending on what we felt that we were most comfortable with. So Andrew and myself, for example, spent a lot of time on the corruption element of the book, whereas we had a couple of very well-respected defense economists, in particular Paul Dunn and Sam Perla Freeman, who contributed a lot to the economic work of it. So we split it up according to where we'd focused on in the past.
It is quite comprehensive, and I should point out that we often hear comparisons between the United States and other countries' defense spending. You provide that and a total for the world, nearly $1.7 trillion in 2015. That's $250 for every person on Earth. Who provides the figures, and how confident are you in them?
We were incredibly confident in them. There's obviously black holes in accounting for defense spending, because there's a lot of countries that don't fully declare how much they spend or they do what's called off-budget expenditure. But fortunately for the world, there is a group in Stockholm called the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and they've existed since the 1960s. They're funded by a number of sources, including the Swedish government, and their entire job is to monitor and track the global arms trade and also monitor and track military expenditure around the world. So they've developed incredibly sophisticated monitoring tools and a very large research team, and they are the ones who provide the most consistent and verifiable figures around the global arms trade and defense spending Every year. If you're interested, and if listeners are interested, they put out what's called the SIPRI Yearbook every year. And the SIPRI Yearbook, most of which is available to read online from their website, provides a breakdown in who's spending what, what the trends are in the international arms trade, and they generally have a focus for each issue of an area of interest as well, such as the impact of defense trade on the economy, the relationship between the defense trade and corruption as well.
Now, the book Indefensible is divided into two major sections. Both of them sound like Obi-Wan talking to a stormtrooper. Section one, there is no problem. Section two, the arms trade can't be beaten. So you're saying, you're putting this out there because you think people can change the global arms trade.
Of course. I mean, I think it's a very powerful industry. I don't think anybody's in denial about that. In the States in particular, the scale of defense spending on lobbying in Congress at the Senate is pretty extreme. But I'm also, I think the world has gone through a number of different campaigns and changes where major things have happened, things that we couldn't even perceive being changed happening. And I come from a country, South Africa, where in my lifetime I witnessed the change from a narrow, racist, I would argue potentially evil regime into a democratic, non-racial country. So I believe in the ability of remarkable change to happen. I think in a number of countries there's already a lot of movements towards reforming the arms trade, making sure it's accountable. So I definitely think it's something that most people might feel slightly intimidated by, but there's definitely activities and actions you can take part in each country.
Back to talk more with Paul Holden and Indefensible when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Paul Holden from Corruption Watch UK. He's put together a book with 12 contributing authors called Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade, not only examining what goes on in the arms trade in the world now, but indicating possibilities for reform so that maybe we're not spending $1.7 trillion worldwide on weapons and military systems every year. 800-838-3760 to join this conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, we were supposed to get a peace dividend when the Cold War ended, did we?
We did for a very brief period of time. There was a fall in global defense spending from roughly 1991 up until 2000. Of course, that ended with September 11. Following 9/11, there was an enormous uptick in the amount that was spent. If you give me a second, I can even bring up the figures for you if you'd like.
Sure.
Defense spending fell from a sort of a high under Ronald Reagan in particular, who really pushed defense spending in the United States, from $1.7 trillion. Around the world in 1988, it fell quite dramatically to just over $1 trillion in around about 1999. And it was after September 11 that we've had this massive uptick, almost doubling the amount of money spent on defense around the world. And I think the important point is that it's not just the U.S. That contributes to the increase in defense expenditure globally, although they are a major contributor. There have been regions around the world that have seen absolutely enormous increases of expenditure over the last 10 years, one of which is Africa, which has nearly doubled the amount of money it spends on military matters over the last 10 years.
Why? And this dovetails with a question that a guest just posted here, which is to ask how towns in the middle of the desert are getting weapons.
How towns in the middle of the desert are getting weapons? I'm assuming he's referring to the conflict in the Middle East.
I would assume so, yeah.
I mean, the sad reality is that the arms are getting there because equipment manufacturers and arms companies around the world, in particular the U.S. and Europe, are selling them to corrupt regimes. I think, you look at the type of weaponry and equipment that, for example, ISIS is using. Quite a large amount of it is taken from U.S. transfers to the new Iraqi government at the end of the Iraq War. There was a study that was done by the Center for Conflict Research in 2014, and what they did was they did a sample of of ammunition. They collected ammunition from various battlefields around where ISIS was operating, and they found that at least 20 to 25% of all the ammunition that ISIS was using was U.S. manufactured. Now that ties in very closely to one of the myths that we deal with, which is something that we're told by governments around the world and told in particular by defense manufacturers, is that we can control where weapons go. That, you know, we will provide weapons to a particular area on the understanding or sort of on the promise that they won't be dispersed around the world. But the reality is that arms are incredibly durable. They last a very long time. Political situations change very rapidly. And when that does happen, you see enormous outflows of arms around the world. Probably the best example of that most recently was following the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. He had been provided with weapons, an enormous quantity of weapons, largely by European suppliers over the last 30 years. There were so many weapons at one stage that he had more planes and tanks that could possibly ever be used in his lifetime by the Libyan army. Now, when Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown, all those weapons were essentially raided by various bandits, by other armed groups, and they have now spread across the region. They were used in the coup d'etat in Mali. They've been found in the hands of al-Shabaab, an Islamic terrorist group in Somalia, and they've made their way all the way into Syria. You know, the simple reality is that the majority of the arms in the world are produced by American and U.S. And European arms suppliers, and they've been sold to governments without a huge degree of concern about where they'll eventually end up.
So the sale is final, and then but there's no control down the line to say, hey, we need to make sure that you're going to keep it in a secure place, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And, you know, the reality is that arms provided to somebody who may seem like an ally now, that person can become very rapidly not an ally. And we've seen that, you know, that's what we call it in our book blowback, which is where, you know, you support one particular group of people and suddenly they become your mortal enemy. And probably the best example of that is the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They were provided with weapons by the United States to fight the Soviets in the late 1980s. And then they became the Taliban. They became America's enemy number one. The same thing happened with Saddam Hussein. He was provided with dual-use items by the United States in the 1980s, and a lot of arms were sold from Europe to him, to Saddam Hussein's regime in the 1980s. And suddenly he becomes again the target of U.S. And European conflict, only a couple years later. So you have the very bizarre situation where the U.S. has been fighting wars in certain cases with people who are armed with equipment that they had supplied. So when we deal with the arms trade, and we do a lot of work around lobbying around export control and trying to limit the amount of weapons that are sold around the world, we always try to emphasize the fact that once a weapon system is sold into an area, you have very little control over what happens to it in the long term. And that's why we think there should be incredibly strong controls over the way in which arms are sold around the world. And they should only be sold in the absence of any real threat that they can be diverted or dispersed into conflict regions.
Paul Holden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the principal author of the book Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. He's already addressed myth number three, we can control where weapons end up and how they're used. Let's come back to myth number one, higher defense spending equals increased security. This is a durable one.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the one that everybody believes, and it's certainly, you know, a myth that is going very strong under the Trump administration. I don't know, he has issued a number of different statements around defense spending. He's promised to increase defense spending in the United States by as much as $1 trillion. Now, that is an absolutely enormous sum of money. That would more than double the amount spent on the military in the U.S. From its current level of around $600 billion. Now, the question is, there are a lot of examples where money has been spent on military equipment, and it doesn't necessarily increase the security that you, any sense of security that you may have. One of the best examples of that is a very contemporary example, which is the F-35. Now, the F-35 is likely to be the most expensive weapon system in the entire world. It's going to cost the United States government between $1 and $1.5 trillion, even with Donald Trump's anticipated discount he's going to get from Lockheed Martin. And there have been serious concerns around the functionality of that plane. There are a number of very noted defense experts in the U.S. who, including, by the way, the person who was responsible for, who was the lead designer on the F-16, who claimed that the current F-35 is less functional, provides less functionality, is less effective in its various roles than the existing fleet of fighter jets that the United States have. To give an example, there was a leaked memorandum of a test of how well the F-35 would perform in what's called dogfights, that's air-to-air combat, against various different types of jets around the world. And I found that in almost all cases of dogfights against jets produced in China and in Russia, it lost. And that's compared against the F-16, which has achieved a great deal of dominance in the United States in the air. So the big question is, why on earth would America spend such an enormous amount of money on a plane that doesn't seem to do its job particularly well? Then there's the other reality that sometimes when you devote so much of your annual budget to defense spending, you'll tend to use the military to resolve problems that aren't really suitable for the military. And that can lead to wars and conflicts that don't do anything to increase your security. You look at the Iraq War, for example, which has cost, according to the Nobel Peace Prize winning, sorry, the Nobel Economics winner, Joseph Stiglitz. He estimates that the war will cost the United States eventually between $3 and $5 trillion, and that includes long-term spending over veterans who need care. And I'd be very hard-pressed to find a single industry analyst or a single security analyst who says the United States is any safer or the world is any safer after that war has been completed.
Which ties back to other issues with the war in Iraq, like the creation of ISIS that eventually grew out of it, which raises questions, too, about the hardware. I mean, why buy things like the F-35 when we have planes that are more effective, although older? When, in particular, if ISIS is the greatest challenge to the United States as perceived by American leaders, they don't have any fighter jets.
No, they don't. I mean, I think that the whole approach to defeating ISIS is very confused. But I will say this. I just want to step back for 1 second. I think that there's this idea of ISIS being a major threat to the United States. I think it has to be addressed at some level. And it's something that we discuss in the final myth of our book. The final myth in our book is that the world is too dangerous for us to do anything about the arms trade. Now, if you look at most Americans' general sense of what is terrifying and what is scary and what is threatening, it is terrorism that's number one on the list. In 2015, for example, the Washington Post, Gallup did a poll, and they found that between 11% of Americans were very worried, and 30% of Americans were somewhat worried that they or a family member would be injured or killed in an act of terrorism in the next year. So that's roughly 110 million American citizens who believe, who genuinely were worried that they or their family member would be affected by terrorism. That's rather strange if you look at the actual figures. The number of terrorist attacks on United States soil, certainly by Islamic terrorists, is incredibly small. The number of international terrorist incidents around the world has been reducing since the 1970s. In the United States, for example, you have a 1 in 20 million chance of being affected by a terrorist attack. You're twice as more likely to die from a terror attack. This is including the figures around September 11. As you are from drowning in your bathtub or being struck by lightning. So I think we should really be very careful about identifying terrorism as a very real existential threat to the United States. That said, you know, most conflicts around the world and how you defeat terrorism is not through battlefield action. There was a great report that was done by the RAND Group. Now, I know whenever in the United States is a very contestable terrain, the RAND Group is generally seen as a very biased, bipartisan think tank. And they look
bipartisan,
at the
ways, not biased.
Not biased at all, bipartisan think tank. And they had this idea of looking into the ways in which terrorism ends around the world. And they did a report called How Terrorism Ends. And what they found was that in only 7% of all terrorist groups around the world did they end through battlefield action. The majority of the time, the terrorist groups were defeated through traditional criminal investigations or through a negotiated solution with a series of partners that ended the preconditions for terrorism. And in fact, what they found was that where there was battlefield action, terrorism was tended to last longer and to be more more persistent because war creates the perfect environment for terrorism to flourish. You have people who are angry, you have people who are traumatized, you have a situation where people may feel incredibly angry at the fact that there are armed forces of another country in their own country, and that tends to fuel terrorism. So I don't see, for example, I don't necessarily see that any sort of defense spending really helps with the fight against terrorism. I think that money would be far better spent on traditional policing methods and on being used on helping to reduce corruption in countries like Iraq and Syria and stabilizing a region and providing for its citizens so they're not attracted to what terrorism offers.
Paul Holden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the Director of Investigations at Corruption Watch UK, based in the UK, looking into corruption and bribery. He has written a book with 12 contributing authors called Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. When we come back again to myth number one, which is that higher defense spending equals increased security, there is the concern about the other countries around you spending more money. And if you don't, I mean, there's that concern that, well, they're going to take us over.
That's true. That's what's called the traditional security dilemma, also known as an arms race, where if you don't, if you don't spend to catch up with your neighbor, then you may be bypassed. The reality, the historical reality, is that on many occasions, what happens there is that you have two parties or two countries or an entire region where one party starts increasing defense spending, and there's a level of distrust. Another party starts increasing defense spending in response to it, and it leads to a spiral of spending. Probably the most classic example of that was the arms race prior to World War I. But we've seen it to a lesser extent in various regions in Africa. There's quite a strong argument that we are seeing that in the Pacific region at the moment as countries respond to increased Chinese defense spending. The reality, the unfortunate reality is the more money you spend on defense, the more likely you are to use the weapons that you buy. So far more, if I was to posit a slightly more reasonable solution, it would be far better if those countries engaged in sort of frank and honest dialogue and used diplomatic measures to reduce distrust. And that would be a far more effective way of securing your long-term security than engaging in a very unhealthy, potentially conflict-ridden arms race.
That is a very hard zone to find, I would think, politically, though, particularly in America, where if you start talking about let's reduce defense spending or let's stand down a little bit, let's reduce some of our capabilities here, the chances are that you're going to get called weak and worse, that you're a cut and runner. I mean, you name it. Any one of those things are going to come raining down upon you.
Sure. I think that is a very realistic worry that we have, and that's the reason why we wrote the book. I don't think that you... I think you have to frame security slightly differently in order to have that argument. And one of the things we do in the book, and one of the things we argue, and certainly the approach that's been taken in many countries around the world, is to redefine security not as just we can defend our borders, which, by the way, in the United States, the idea that there's another power in the world that could possibly ever match the size of the United States military is just utterly absurd. The amount of money the United States has spent on the military over the last 20 years massively dwarfs any capacity that any other major power can be putting out. Every year, the United States spends more than the next seven largest countries, that's including China and Russia, combined. You also have to look at the fact that the United States has United States allies also tend to dominate defense spending. You know, if you add United States defense spending and NATO defense spending together, you're looking at over 60% of military spending in the whole world. So the U.S. and its allies spend far more than other states around the world. to get back to my original point, the way that security is defined by the UN is as human security. Now, human security is defined as freedom from want and indignity and poverty. That's not the exact technical definition. But I would argue that defense spending tends to reduce human security rather than increase it. And if you want to have a robust debate on the United States, maybe it's about time to reframe how you think about security.
That is not just defending the borders and keeping out foreign invaders, but taking care of people within the borders. We can talk about this more with Paul Holden when we come back and talk more about the book that he is the principal author of, Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll get into phone calls and emails when we return from this break. Back on the Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Holden, who is the Director of Investigations at Corruption Watch UK. As the name implies, he is in the UK, and he and 12 other contributing authors have ganged up on a book called Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade, ranging from higher defense spending equals increased security to national security requires blanket secrecy. All sorts of myths that they attempt to explode in the book. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The book is not American-centric, although it's easy to talk about the United States, because when you look at $1.7 billion spent on defense every year, about a third of that is the United States around the world. But you do point out, too, that while we talk about the political perils in a democracy, in a democratic system like the United States, to opposing more defense spending, you also get into the fact that there are non-democratic countries like Saudi Arabia that are laying out more money. What's the rationale there?
I mean, I think it depends. You know, each country has a different sort of dynamic. I would say that in a lot of those countries, corruption is a major feature of those trades. The arms trade is an incredibly good way for corrupt elites in countries like Saudi Arabia to launder money into private hands. And in fact, Saudi Arabia is probably the best example of it. They, according to Transparency International, which is a, for your listeners who don't know, is an international group that monitors corruption perceptions around the world and the risks of different countries being involved in corruption. Saudi Arabia scores it's in the lowest possible band for the risk of corruption. It gets a score of F, which means that there is an incredibly high risk that every defense contract involved in Saudi Arabia has an element of corruption within it. A lot of occasions, the weapons that are bought have no utility. One of the best examples of that was a jet fighter called the Typhoon, which was sold by the UK supplier BAE Systems to Saudi Arabia from the 1980s, and they've signed a more recent deal. And that plane has very rarely been able to actually be used in the Saudi environment because it's very bad for being operated in the desert. And yet enormous quantities of it were bought. U.S. investigations discovered that there was at least $1 billion in bribes that were paid on that particular transaction. And that money went to a series of very well-connected Saudi royal family members. There was a very frank interview given by a senior American military advisor for Transparency International on Saudi Arabia, and he pointed out that Saudi Arabia buys a whole series of weapon systems that don't really relate to each other, seem to have no particular use, but always seem to have massively inflated prices, which appears to be the margin for bribery. Another example, although it's not a dictatorship, is Nigeria, where an enormous sum of money has been essentially stolen through off-budget expenditure over the last 25 years. There is what's called the Dasuki Gate at the moment, where over $1 billion of military aid that was given to Nigeria that was supposed to be spent on weapons to fight Boko Haram has essentially been pilfered out of the country altogether. So in a lot of those cases, it's spent, you know, the money, what drives the arms trade is corruption. Unfortunately, the other element of it is it provides the means for corrupt regimes and dictatorial regimes to maintain power. and to oppress their own citizens or oppress the citizens of other countries. Again, I'll turn to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is under a voluntary EU embargo, arms embargo, because they have been engaged in massive human rights violation in Yemen by blanket bombing civilian areas, including schools and funerals. And the biggest suppliers to Saudi Arabia, by the way, are the US and the UK. So, unfortunately, when it goes to arms are being sold to dictatorships and very undemocratic states, there's usually very poor reasons for us to sell it to them, yet we continue to do so.
Well, and Saudi Arabia, as you point out, it's one of its major concerns, major rivals, is Iran, which you claim as a far weaker state. But this book was written before the recent ballistic missile test. I wonder if that changes your view at all.
No, I don't think it does, in the sense that, I know this is a very combustible and contestable issue in the United States at the moment, so I'll try and tread up it carefully. But I do think that the Iran nuclear deal was an incredibly powerful and successful achievement for what diplomacy can achieve in a very conflict-ridden, unstable area. And it seems very clear from the various agreements that were part of the nuclear deal that Iran is not on the way to developing a nuclear weapon. And one of the great features of the Iran nuclear deal was allowing, unlike in Iraq, for a very robust inspection regime by the United States, by its various partners, including the UK and France, and by international agencies like the International Atomic Energy Agency, to be granted access to all sorts of facilities in Iran to investigate and ensure that there's no enrichment of uranium. I think that generally speaking, the Iran nuclear deal has done a great deal to reduce any potential threat on the part of Iran developing nuclear weapons. So I don't think that a ballistic missile test necessarily changes the military balance in that particular region. If you also consider the fact that there are a number of countries who are essentially allied against Iran in the region, that includes Israel, which has an enormous military budget and receives considerable military aid from the United States, I don't see how one ballistic missile test really changes that very fundamental balance. You know, Saudi Arabia is the third largest importer of weapons, the largest importer of weapons in the world, and the third largest spender, military spender in the world. Iran is nowhere close to that.
Wow. As long as we're talking about Iran, let's bring Skeeter and Eugene into the conversation. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Holden, the principal author of Indefensible.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Hi, Paul. Thank you. I'm wondering if, Paul, if you remember back in the early 1980s, there were strong allegations that the Reagan administration had made deals prior to the election in 1980 to hold the hostages that the Iranians had captured, our American hostages, and to hold them and not release them until after the election. Apparently, that happened, and the weapons that the Reagan administration had said that they would give to the Iranians, I heard that the weapons that were actually given to the Iranians were taken out of NATO stockpiles, leaving Western Europe quite vulnerable for a while. Is that true?
Unfortunately, that's a bit of a gray and a bit of a murky area. I mean, I've certainly read a huge amount about that particular hostage swap. I've always found it personally quite remarkable how almost as soon as Ronald Reagan was elected, so the key members of key hostages were released almost directly afterwards. And I've heard that allegation has been made incredibly strongly. In terms of the source of the arms, nobody's ever been able to verify it 100%. So I'm not going to, I can't give you a 100% answer that it was entirely from NATO stockpiles. What I will point out is that, ironically, considering that Iran became America's number one enemy from 1979 onwards, that didn't stop America from trading weapons with Iran for much of the 1980s. Certainly the Iran-Contra affair shows that the United States was willing to engage in essentially mass criminality around the world, which included weapon sales with Iran.
We have not talked yet about the myth of job creation here, or as you see it, a myth of job creation. So the idea that lots of people end up with lots of jobs because of building things like the F-35 fighter, which certainly does sprinkle a lot of money in several different states, but you have a problem with this.
I do. I mean, I think the reality is that you spend that amount of money on producing anything, and you're going to be creating a large number of jobs. The question is whether that's an economically efficient way to create jobs. And all the studies seem to suggest that it's the exact opposite of that. And there's a number of reasons for that, one of which is that arms production, certainly in sophisticated arms productions like the F-35, they are not very labor-intensive. They're very capital-intensive. They use quite a lot of machinery. So the number of jobs created is far less than the jobs created in other industries. So there was a study done by the University of Massachusetts in 2012, which compared the amount of jobs that would be created if you spent $1 billion on defense versus $1 billion in pretty much any other sector. And the sectors they focused on were clean energy, healthcare, and education. Also, they factored in how many jobs would be created by facilitating $1 billion in tax cuts. And what they found was that, roughly speaking, for every $1 billion that's spent on defense spending in the United States, 11,000 jobs are created. And that was much lower than any other sector. The sector that created the most amount of jobs was education. They found out that the number of jobs created in education was around about 26,700, which is almost more than double what is created in terms of jobs by the defense sector. I think what doesn't get discussed quite a lot in the United States is a thing called offsets or divestment, mm-hmm. global divestment. Now, what happens there is that it's very common in defense trades around the world, where if a defense manufacturer sells to a country like India, for example, they promise to invest a certain amount in that country's economy. That usually takes the form of moving jobs to various different countries. So BAE Systems, for example, setting up a manufacturing capacity in India.
So a buy India kind of thing, or a build India kind of thing.
Exactly, and that, you know, that reduces the amount of jobs that are created around the world. So there was a good example in the United Kingdom. Roughly at the time that BAE Systems was being investigated for corruption, gross corruption by the Serious Fraud Office here, there were a whole number of advertisements they put out around the world, around the UK, which said that if you cancelled, that the BAE Systems was responsible for 55,000 jobs in the country. When the analysis was actually done, the number of direct jobs that were created in the United Kingdom was much smaller than that. It was about half of that. The majority of the jobs they referred to were actually in countries like India, South Africa, where they had a defense production deal. So in terms of economic efficiency and creating jobs, it's very poor. There's also some very interesting data coming out of defense economists at the moment, which is probably a slightly technical discussion for most of your readers. But there is a very thriving subset of economics which looks at the impact of defense spending on countries holistically. So, you know, if you spend this amount of your budget on defense, how does it affect your growth rates over time? And it seems the consensus that's emerging from all studies that have been done since 1990 is that if you spend money on defense, the more money you spend on defense, the lower your levels of internal economic growth rate are, which would tend to suggest that that spending money on defense is bad for your economy. And if you were to spend money on pretty much any other sector, it would generate far more return for you.
Which leads to a broader discussion of other ways to potentially spend money that you see as creating greater security, and we're talking human security here, not just like shielded from weapons and armies from other country. And you put climate change right there on top.
Sure. I mean, I think this is what I think a lot of people around the world, and certainly I would consider probably the greatest threat facing humanity at the moment, is uncontrolled climate change. You know, the potential for it creating any number of resource conflicts around the world, creating massive uncertainty and resettlement, threatening food security, is pretty profound. And the amount of money that's spent on subsidies for fighting climate change, certainly in the West, is far less than what's spent on defense. And I think you would achieve far more in terms of long-term security outcomes by spending on a program like that. Now, I know that some people would balk at the idea of climate change being real. I very much disagree with them. But I think there's other avenues as well which can increase human security. I think in the United States, there is something to be said for the fact that there is less emphasis placed on diplomacy and the role of the State Department in resolving conflicts around the world and essentially making friends around the world. The State Department gets less federal dollars every year than Lockheed Martin does. And I think that limits the ability of the State Department to effectively undertake its mandate, which is to secure agreements to the benefit of the United States and to find negotiated solutions to problems. And I think that speaks to a fundamental issue, a fundamental reality, which is that a lot of very intractable, complex global problems are resolved through collaboration and cooperation, not through war.
Well, there's a lot to take in this book, and we have not even touched on all the myths that are listed here. The book is called Indefensible: 7 Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. Worth a read. Paul Holden put it together with 12 other co-authors. Paul is the director of investigations at Corruption Watch UK. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.